News, culture, and NPR.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, New York's climate goals. The state is not on track to meet its benchmarks to reduce gas emissions and achieve zero emission electricity. We'll find out why and get more from the New York Public News Network. What are the advantages, disadvantages, and responsibilities of being called a Latino in local politics? La Voz Magazine is hosting a roundtable discussion with active Hispanics in local politics to answer these and other questions, such as voter participation. Patricio Barbayo speaks to Mariel Fiore, co-founder and director of La Voz. And it's Monday. We check in with James B. Huntington for Local Economic Perspective on Work Shift Live. And it's apple picking season. The historic North Branch Cider Mill, established in 1942, is hoping to press apples once again. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israel continues to conduct strikes on southern Lebanon, and Hezbollah militants are still firing rockets into northern Israel. The deputy leader of Hezbollah says the group will soon pick a new chief, and he says if Israel launches a ground offensive into Lebanon, the militants will be ready. Israel assassinated the longtime leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, last Friday. NPR's Jane Araf reports from Beirut he will soon be buried.
He will be buried sometime this week, it's expected, but so far no details. And in the meantime, just waves and waves of people displaced from the south of Lebanon, the south of Beirut, and nowhere for a lot of them to stay.
NPR's Jane Araf reporting. President Biden is scheduled to speak this hour about federal efforts to help people affected by Hurricane Helene. The storm's death toll is climbing toward 100 people across six states. The full toll is not yet known because authorities in some states cannot yet reach some affected people. Helene came ashore last week on Florida's Gulf Coast as a Category 4 hurricane. The storm's surge in some areas was several feet high. NPR's Frank Morris reports the psychological toll of the storm is affecting many people.
Helene took a lot from people like Carol Judy in tiny Arapica, Florida, on the Gulf Coast. The storm almost killed her. She wrote it out on the roof of her small one-story house. Nearly all her possessions are gone. Judy is stunned.
Anxiety? Oh my gosh, the anxiety is to the roof. And you know, with anxiety comes physical things that happen to you. And
Judy's 59. She has lupus. And like a lot of other people in coastal Florida, she is uninsured. She's getting help from family and has plans to request federal assistance, but she's in limbo for now. Frank Morris, NPR News, Arapica, Florida.
Stocks open mixed this morning as ports along the East Coast and Gulf Coast brace for a possible dock workers' strike. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped about 150 points in early trading.
Tens of thousands of longshoremen are set to go on strike at midnight. If no deal is reached before then, a work stoppage would idle shipping traffic at three dozen ports in the east and southeast. The dock workers are pushing for higher pay and limits on automation. Satellite companies DirecTV and Dish TV are merging. The two companies tried to combine years ago, but the deal was blocked over antitrust concerns. That's less of an issue now that video streaming has eclipsed satellite service. Asian stocks were mixed overnight. Japan's Nikkei average tumbled nearly 5% in anticipation of the country's new prime minister, while stocks were higher in Hong Kong and Shanghai. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down about 138 points. This is NPR. Georgia authorities say a fire at a chemical plant east of Atlanta has been sending plumes of smoke into the air. Residents in Rockdale County have been sheltering in place since yesterday. Officials say a sprinkler at the plant in the city of Conyers malfunctioned and sprayed water on a chemical, causing a reaction. When a coal-fired power plant north of London turns off its turbines tonight, Britain will become the first major developed economy to phase out coal altogether. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from the plant in Ratcliffe-on-Soar, England.
This is the UK's last coal-fired power station. Smokestacks and eight giant cooling towers dominate the landscape. But today is the last day steam vapor is spewing out of them. The plant turns off at midnight local time and is slated to be demolished in 2 years. Coal power fueled Britain's rise, the Industrial Revolution, and expansion of the empire. Since the 1960s, the UK has been switching to North Sea natural gas and renewables as its economy has shifted away from manufacturing. Britain is the first major developed country to quit coal, and it aims to quit all fossil fuel electricity in 6 years. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Ratcliffe-on-Soar, England.
In France, the former leader of the far-right group The National Rally is on trial. Marine Le Pen and several allies are accused of embezzling European Parliament funds for party activities. She has strongly denied this. Le Pen is considered a strong rival to French President Emmanuel Macron. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll get to New York's climate goals as part of the 2019 Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act in just a few minutes. But first, as part of Hispanic Heritage Month, La Voz Magazine, in collaboration with the City of Kingston and Radio Kingston, are hosting a panel moderated by journalist Mariel Fiore, Latinos in Local Politics. The discussion will explore the advantages, disadvantages, and responsibilities of being Latino in local politics. Mariel Fiore is the managing editor of La Voz Magazine, which has been a key voice in the Latino community in the Hudson Valley. She's an advocate for Latino representation, known for her journalistic contributions and community engagement efforts. And you can hear her show La Voz en Breve, which airs Monday nights here on Radio Catskill. Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio spoke to Mariel Fiore.
It's super important. This is something that was mandated by the government. We have to start there. But we really like celebrations because this is about celebrating the achievements and contribution of Hispanic American leaders who have inspired others to achieve success here in the United States and also around the world, in Latin America, but that they have influenced us here. So it's a month that starts with September 15. It's actually the Independence Day for Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Costa Rica. September 16 is the Independence Day for Mexico and Chile. Chile is for September 18, and Belize is on September 21. So the beginning of Hispanic Heritage Month also coincides with the celebration of Independence Day for a lot of Latin American countries. And ends in October. Mm-hmm. I don't like the end. The end has to do with the arrival of the Europeans to the continent from Spain. Christopher Columbus was what is now known as Italy, but he was paid by the Spanish crown. That's why everyone in Latin America speaks Spanish. But that's the end of the month. I still think it's very important to continue to talk about the celebration, the contributions and achievements of Hispanics. And I would love it to be the year round. We are about 20% of the population in this country. The census puts us at 65 million. So how come we are almost 20% of population, 65 million, still in a lot of English-speaking media and print media, the national, the local, we barely show up in the news. We're like 5% of the time, things like that. But then you look behind who is in those newsrooms, and unfortunately, we don't have enough representations of Latinos in the newsrooms. And this goes across the board in other professions as well, in the school system, things like that, politics. And this is why we're going to have this panel about Latinos in local politics to say, yes, we are very little doing a lot of things, but let's hear from these very few that are doing it, and maybe we can learn about why is it important to involve in politics in many different aspects.
And you talk about the lack of representation in politics, especially during this political climate that we do live in, especially immigration being such a prominent topic as we approach the 2024 elections. What is the sense that you get from some of the politicians you have spoken about the rhetoric that some of the Republican party leaders, namely Trump, President Trump, former President Trump, talks about how he talks about the southern border, the immigrants that are coming in, and you can see what's happening with his rhetoric when it comes to what he talks about the Haitian migrants who are eating dogs and cats, and which we know is a debunked statement.
And there is also a point to clarify. I just say 65 million people that were born of the Hispanics that were born in the United States, is like over 60% of that of those 65 million were born in the United States. Since the year 2000 and mostly since 2010, 1 million Hispanic babies were born every year in the United States. And in those years, since 2010 to now, about 350,000 immigrants from Latin American countries have come per year. So the driver of Hispanic growth, the Hispanic population growth, are native-born Hispanics. That means U.S. citizens. So when we talk about Hispanics, it's not just that image that makes people frown and all of these words that are used against people, making dehumanizing people with the word illegal, for example. So you have to be very careful when, because we're talking about 65 million people, most of them U.S. citizens. And a lot of them can also vote. And this is the problem, that a lot of people are still disengaged from voting, mostly young people. And I know there are a lot of campaigns like Voto de Latino, Gen Vote. All these groups are trying to encourage young people to vote. Most of the young people, I say one in five people in the United States, 20% is Latino. But among the young people is one in four, 25%. So the future is Latino. And my question is, how are we going to make sure that all of these youngsters, being Latino or not, they are really involved in politics? Because that's a way to change situations.
You mentioned about the diversity that we do have in the Latino population. I was talking to somebody else about this recently, about how diverse the Latino population is. A lot of times the media likes to lump every Hispanic and Latino community into one block, voting block, really. but it's such a diverse community from South American countries, from the Caribbean. And you talk about the first generation Latinos. For me personally, I was born here in this country. My parents are from Ecuador and Puerto Rico. And when this whole southern border thing was heating up, a lot of folks came to me and were apologizing to me or talked to me about what it took to get to this country. And that's unfortunately the problem we have, is that automatically you're judged by how you look or how your name looks or things like that. And I have to correct a lot of people. It's like, no, I'm born here. I'm American here.
The statistic, according to the Pew Hispanic Center, is a Pew Research Center, and the Hispanic part of them is 81%. That's 4 out of 5 Latinos are U.S. citizens, 81%. Of course, there are a lot of minors, so not everyone can vote. So go on, Patricia. And I think having this conversation is a way of turning the table on the hateful messaging that sometimes we hear.
Yeah, yeah. Someone like you who's actively involved and you're amplifying the Latino voices through La Voz, how do you think media can influence Latino representation in politics or getting young folks or anybody interested in politics and going out there to vote, thinking their vote matters? Because that's what I get. That's why I feel that a lot of folks who are in the younger age or in the past, I don't know by now, but I always felt like their vote didn't matter, because in everyday life, sometimes they feel like forgotten.
If their voice didn't matter, no one would care about this gerrymandering of districts, of making maps that use the value of your vote. They wouldn't be caring about cleaning the voting registry. In Maricopa County, Arizona, they just took down 100,000 people from the voting registration. They say that these people never show, I don't know, they never show a birth certificate. So if your voice didn't matter, then no one would make so much effort going to court doing all of these things or creating laws that disenfranchise people from voting. So I think that if there wasn't such a great pressure in certain circles to make sure that people don't vote, then that's the great proof that actually your voice matters, that your vote, each vote is super important. And in terms of the Latinos in the United States, yes, we come from all over, mostly from Mexico, but also from Puerto Rico, from the Dominican Republic, Guatemala, Colombia, Honduras, Cuba, Salvador. I am personally from Argentina. So yeah, we come from all different flavors. There are some things that connect us and unite us. For some of us, is the Spanish language. For some, it's just the cultures that have some of Spanish in there, like from our ancestors. But we are not talking about indigenous languages. That, for example, my grandmother spoke an indigenous language. And it should be included when we talk about Hispanics or Latinos. It's not just our Spanish heritage from the colony of Spain, which, yes, that's part of it, but there's more. And that's, I think, is the richness of celebrating this month.
I'm glad you said that because, yeah, it's not only from the Spanish, European Spanish who came here and colonized everybody and have what we have now, but yeah, absolutely right. The indigenous population that was there in Puerto Rico and other countries, and my mother was Puerto Rican, and she always talked about her Taino roots. She always celebrated it, always talked about it. I know when I went to Puerto Rico as an older adult, that was something I was very interested in, just this shift that happened of the folks that were here before the Europeans came by and colonized everything. But you're absolutely right. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Wanted to mention, going back to your question about me, I am a member of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. I just turned 40 years old. I was at the conference. It was very well attended. However, it wasn't so many people as I saw before in other conferences. And this is something, it's the reality of, because it's also a business. And most of the time, people that come are from the TV. And the television is not doing as well. And when they have to fire or hire, the first ones to fire are the minorities, let's say. So that would be the Hispanics. So there were less than other minorities. There were fewer people in this conference. And one conversation all along was, okay, everyone understands that we need more diversity, more Latinos in media and in other aspects, in other positions of power. The reality is that the system sometimes doesn't allow for that. So we have to continue to fight in other ways. If you cannot do mass media, okay, do a small publication in Spanish for the region you live. Do a radio show that maybe Radio Catskill will air. This type of thing helps expand the discourse. They were also talking about that we need to go to TikTok. People are confused. What is the media that people consume? I work with a lot of students at Bard College, and the first day of our meeting for La Voz magazine, I asked them, okay, well, what news you want to share here? And they share a piece of news, and I say, where did you read or where did you learn that? And a lot of people tell me, I learned this from TikTok. And so that's what we're fighting against. That's misinformation, basically.
Yeah. A lot of the young folks are getting their media from social media, and we hope that they are smart enough to make sure to correct their sources, because it could be a lot of misinformation that's happening on social media.
Yes.
So, and just looking forward to now, let's talk about this event, more about this event that's happening on Thursday, October 17th, Kingston City Hall. Who are some of the folks that you have on stage with you?
I am excited that we have a quite diverse panel, people that work in politics, like elected officials, people that work for political parties from not just two, but three different political parties. We have Sandra Cuellar Oxford. She's a co-chair and secretary of the Working Family Parties for New York. She's also a political and community organizer at New York State Nurses Association. We'll talk about the labor. We'll talk about politics. And this is something that just happened recently. The Teamsters, or people usually think in general, that unions will always align with Democrats. But we're following the news right now that the Teamsters are like, I'm not sure where we're going to go. So we'll talk about what's the role of unions in politics. Ruben Estrada is another one of the people that's going to be in the roundtable discussion. He's a founder and chairman of the Latino National Republic Republican Coalition of New York State. So this is a Latino of Puerto Rican descent who is a very strong Republican and specifically Trump supporter. It's very interesting, his point of view as well. So we want to hear from him. Then we'll have Sheriff Juan Figueroa. He's also a county sheriff. He's also Boricua. He's Democrat in this case. But it's also interesting because he's a black man, Latino black man with a very strong position of power, which is the police. So we'll talk about that. Kevin Darian Lujan is an Orange County legislator, as well as Genesis Ramos. She's an Orange County legislator. So these three, Juan Figueroa, Lujan, and Ramos, they're the three of them elected officials. So that's also interesting to see Latinos in those positions of power. And we'll talk with Eddie Monroy. He's a young guy, a young man who is now the deputy campaign manager for Senator Hinchy. And he's also working for the coordinated campaigns with Congressman Pat Ryan for New York Democrats. I think it's going to be a very interesting conversation. And as I say, a diversity of ways that Latinos can get involved in local politics.
And this event is open, free to the public, and it will be in English and with a Spanish interpretation, refreshments given. I just want to talk about representation again. That topic became more important to me after the birth of my daughter and realizing what she watches on the TV. And now that there are our representation and more now in shows, like, for example, Sesame Street and PBS always had Latinos and Latinas on the programming, but now he's even more. Like, my daughter watches a show called Alma, which is a girl who's a Hispanic living in the Bronx and riding on the 6 train, which is, you know, perfect for me because that's where I grew up. I grew up in the Bronx in a Hispanic family riding the 6 train. And it's great that she's able to see that now and she sees herself in that. And for her, it's a normal thing. But growing up, it wasn't always, didn't always happen. It was few or far between when you see actual Latinos and Latinas on TV and in TV programs. And most of the time when you do see them, they're either the robber, they're either the superintendent of the building, or they're the buddy, or you know, something that's sort of in bad light of Hispanics. Very few Hispanics or Latinos on TV during the 80s and 90s and the 70s that were seen in better light on TV. I don't know if you want to comment on that and how important representation is in all aspects of life, not only in politics, but on TV and seeing other folks who look like us in places of power.
Totally. Well, I not just in politics, but all places of power have some sort of politics embedded into it. The fact that you see yourself reflected means that you can also be there. You can also get into that position. And it's a source of inspiration. So people don't feel that despair, I'm not worth it. And this is something that for another day, maybe the issue of self-racism, I forgot the term that's usually used, but it's when you don't consider yourself enough because you don't see yourself reflected. Everything is nothing shows who you are. Everything is up about other people, but you are never there. And when you see that, you feel like, okay, you are not important. It's that self-inflicted racism. And some people like would not even try to do something because they feel that's not the place for them. But we are in the United States of America, and I feel like this is a country of opportunities, and we need to find those opportunities and fight for them. And when we start seeing that representation, this is a source of inspiration. And I am really inspired and hopeful whenever I see those type of things.
Yeah, oh, definitely. So am I. So, Mario, before we go, is there anything else that we have not touched on that you want folks to know about either La Voz or any upcoming shows that you have or anything else about the Latinos and Local Politics Roundtable?
Yes, I have to say thank you to the City of Kingston, particularly Council Member Ginny Edwards from Ward 4 for helping facilitate all of this. Also, Radio Kingston will be live streaming the event. Hopefully, people can come in person. It's a very big space, the chambers, Council Chambers at the City Hall in Kingston for 20 Broadway. But if you cannot, we are going to live stream it on Facebook on Radio Kingston site, and we also have a shorter version for the listeners of Radio Catskill. So I think if you really want to listen to this conversation, there will be many opportunities.
We're talking to Mario Fiore, host of La Voz, that airs right here on Radio Catskill on Mondays at 11 p.m. Thank you so much for talking to me and talking to me about this roundtable discussion that's coming up in Kingston. Also talk to me about Hispanic Heritage Month. I do really appreciate it.
Muchas gracias, Patricio.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Robayo for Radio Catskill.
And our election coverage continues tomorrow night as we bring you NPR's live special coverage of the CBS News Vice Presidential Debate simulcast. That's tomorrow night at 9. And our local candidate interviews continue as well. We'll hear from Michelle Frazier, the Democrat challenging Republican incumbent Peter Oberocker for the 51st State Senate District in New York. That's later this week. We're keeping you connected this election season. We'll take a break, and when we come back, under the 2019 Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, New York has goals and benchmarks in place to reduce gas emissions and to achieve zero-emission electricity in the next few years, but the state's way behind in trying to meet them. We'll learn more after a break. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Furniture Restore, located on Main Street in Jeffersonville, specializing in antique and vintage furniture, rugs, art, and lighting, because buying well-made and pre-owned is a better choice for the planet. Online at therestorejville.com. And from The River Reporter, the community newspaper serving four counties along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania and New York, riverreporter.com. And from listeners like you.
I'm Bill Williams. Join me for the Kingfisher Project on Tuesday when my guest, Jessica Hoppe, will discuss her brand new memoir, First in the Family, a story of survival, recovery, and the American dream.
When I entered recovery, it was shocking in a way that made me feel a little ashamed that I was somehow, you know, not privy to information that I should have been, that I should have known more. I felt kind of dumb.
That's the Kingfisher Project, Tuesday night at 6, here on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On July 18th, 2019, the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, or Climate Act, was signed into law in New York. New York State's Climate Act requires the state to reduce economy-wide greenhouse gas emissions 40% by 2030 and no less than 85% by 2050 from 1990 levels. But as of today, the state is not on track to meet those goals, and that's for a number of reasons. Elise Klein of the New York Public News Network dove into the state's approach to its environmental goals and the work ahead.
At a time when states across the nation face the impacts of climate change, New York is trying to reach several environmental goals they set for themselves back in 2019 to dramatically decrease greenhouse gas emissions. The Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, also called the Climate Act or the CLCPA, which passed in Albany in 2019, established goals to achieve zero-emission electricity by 2040 and reduce emissions by 85% below 1990 levels by 2050. Leading up to these big goals, the state also set smaller goals such as achieving 70% renewable energy and reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 40% from 1990 levels by 2030. Jeff Friedman, a research faculty member at the Atmospheric Sciences Research Center at SUNY Albany, says the state's goals are part of the solution to combating climate change.
I think they're laudable. I think this is the way to go. I think New York has always been a leader in this, and I'm happy to see this. And I think, you know, I'm confident that we'll be able to meet these goals.
To achieve the goals set forth by the 2019 state law, the Climate Act created a Climate Action Council. The Climate Action Council is made up of climate experts, state agency representatives, and climate advocates. The 22 members were appointed by the governor and legislative leaders from the Assembly and the Senate. Robert Howarth, a professor of ecology and environmental biology at Cornell University, was appointed as a Climate Action Council member by the Assembly Speaker. He says the climate goals are aggressive but achievable.
The goals are required, really. The entire world has to move at least that quickly to decarbonize if we are to reduce the risk of runaway catastrophic global warming.
In December of 2021, the council drafted a scoping plan that outlines recommended policies and actions. The 445-page scoping plan was finalized a year later after holding 11 public hearings throughout the state. Doreen Harris, co-chair of the Climate Action Council, says the scoping plan is a roadmap.
In many ways, that scoping plan provided us with a framework to execute against, and certainly that's what we've been doing as a state.
The scoping plan is widely supported by climate experts and advocates. However, some advocates with the Environmental Justice Alliance say there are some things within the plan they do not support, such as allowing the consideration of a low-carbon fuel standard and calling it a false solution to clean air. The scoping plan's recommendations include regulations and programs to help the state achieve its emission reduction goals. The council is required to prepare and vote on a scoping plan every 5 years. They are also responsible for assembling advisory panels. One state program within the plan called Cap and Invest intends to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by putting an annual cap on the level of greenhouse gas pollution. John Binder, Deputy Commissioner for Climate Change, Air Resources, and Energy at the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, says the program will provide a regulatory mechanism to ensure and enforce emission reduction.
There's a legal, regulatory, enforceable emissions cap that goes down every year. And so we will be having that cap go down on a trajectory that gets us towards that 40% by 2030 emission reduction requirement and the 85% by 2050 emission reduction requirement.
Binder says the invest side of the program is also key to helping the state reduce emissions.
We auction what are called emission allowances, and emission allowances are essentially an approval to emit 1 ton of emissions. So the source that is subject to this program has emits over the course of a year 100,000 tons of greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere. They also will have to obtain 100,000 of these emission allowances.
Winder adds the emission allowances could generate billions of dollars for the state.
And we can invest those proceeds in things to make sure that the program is implemented in an affordable manner so that we're not creating a burden on energy costs for consumers. But at the same time, we can also invest in things that help to further transition the economy to a clean energy economy.
The Cap and Invest program is one of many ways the state is trying to reach their goals. Another method is offshore wind turbines. As part of the state's goal to establish a zero-emission electricity system, there is a set goal to generate 9,000 megawatts of offshore wind power by 2035.
Offshore wind is one of these game-changing technologies for New York State. It has, first of all, the benefit of a massive ability to inject renewables into the New York City and Long Island region, where we have trouble siting other types of renewable energy. And its scale creates real opportunities to get after the decarbonization of our grid.
Rory Christian, chair of the Public Service Commission, agrees, saying offshore wind is a significant part of their progress.
Offshore wind can provide us with a significant amount of emissions-free resources to offset much of the combustion used for electric generation today. So I see it as a very critical aspect of our overall program.
Harris says NYSERDA continues to build the offshore wind pipeline through their offshore wind program. She highlighted one complete project in South Fork and two under construction expected to be operational by 2026. Another method for the state to achieve its emission reduction goals is targeting the transportation and building sectors and moving them away from greenhouse gases. Harris says this process in particular is a big undertaking.
Buildings and transportation are actually the largest sources of greenhouse gas emissions in our state. And they're in some ways the most challenging to decarbonize because of the fact that we have 7 million households across our state. And fundamentally, there needs to be action in each one of those households to achieve these goals.
Harris says the good news is that there are readily available technologies like electric vehicles.
In the last 2 years alone, electric vehicle sales have increased by over 400% in New York State, well over 10% of sales as we speak. So that's a real inflection point that consumers are adopting these technologies ever more so.
While the state is making progress towards reaching its goals, many advocates and experts argue they are falling behind. While the state has met deadlines like establishing the scoping plan, it has missed several other deadlines to implement programs and regulations within that plan.
In the scoping plan in December 2022, we said that the Cap and Invest should be fully implemented by the end of 2023. Well, you know, we're almost 2 years later and they're still taking public input and discussing and debating. And I think that's extremely disappointing.
But Howarth says the biggest disappointment is the lack of progress to transition the state's building sector to renewable energy.
If we want to reach that 2030 goal of reducing statewide emissions by 40%, we have got to do that for the building sector, or else there's no way.
Advocates and climate experts aren't the only ones who are frustrated. Some Republican lawmakers say from day one, there has been a lack of proper planning.
A goal is not a plan. And they've lacked a plan since day one with the CLCPA, which is exactly why they're not going to achieve any of these goals.
Some legislative leaders agree, saying it is simply impossible.
I don't see any reason, any way to say that this is achievable. So, I think the science and anyone that looks at this rationally would say the same thing.
Some Democratic members disagree. State Senator Pete Harcum says the Climate Act's goals are ambitious but achievable. He also stresses the importance of curbing greenhouse gas pollution as soon as possible. The Department of Environmental Conservation says they are working hard to implement programs and regulations, but the public input process is taking longer than expected.
In my couple of decades here at the agency, just about, I've never seen this kind of intensive stakeholder outreach process for a regulatory program, and that's a good thing.
Other state agencies say several other challenges have delayed their progress, especially when it came to large new construction projects, including the pandemic, inflation, supply chain constraints, and interest rate challenges.
These are once in a generational events individually, but collectively, they're paradigm shifts. So we have to look at the plans that we've made many years ago, understand how the reality of events today have affected those plans, and make adjustments accordingly.
Christian adds the agencies are working well together and they are moving ahead with speed to make up for lost time. Some environmental justice advocates argue while agencies are doing what they can, the governor's office has failed. Eunice Koh, deputy director at the New York City Environmental Justice Alliance, says state agencies need strong leadership to help shift the state to renewable energy.
On the executive side, we've seen a lack of urgency and leadership coming from Governor Hochul.
Paul DeMichelle, a communications representative from the governor's office, responded, saying Governor Hochul has implemented some of the nation's strongest actions on climate, highlighting budgetary and policy measures to accelerate the pace of clean energy development. The governor also recently spoke at the state's annual Clean Energy Summit, which outlined the next steps to support the state's progress towards its emission reduction climate goals.
So we have a lot of responsibility on our shoulders. If you didn't feel it, I just put it on yours. It's heavy. It's heavy. But we will not fail the future. Failure is not an option. This is New York. We can figure this out.
The next steps outlined during the summit included advancing the state's agency actions towards supporting a zero-emissions electricity system and soliciting industry feedback on advanced nuclear technologies. Greg Lancet, president of the New York State Pipe Trades Association, who attended the climate summit, says nuclear technologies could be a good solution for alternative energy that could help the state catch up on its climate progress.
The new technology with the nuclear reactors, they're much smaller footprints of the traditional reactors that were built in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So it's a small, compact solution that provides ample amounts of electricity and a very high reliability.
But some climate experts have reservations.
In the scoping plan, we debated nuclear power, and we really didn't see much of a role for new nuclear power because it's expensive and slow to deploy, and we can meet the goals more cheaply and more quickly with wind, solar, hydro, and appropriate storage.
While state agencies and state leaders discuss the option of nuclear power, some state lawmakers have a different solution to meet the climate goals: extend the deadline. Republican lawmakers in the Senate recently introduced a package of bills related to the state's climate goals. One bill would delay the Climate Act's mandates by 10 years.
I think the message is certainly from our conference and from our colleagues, Republicans in the Senate, has been very clear that we need to re-look at this, readdress it, and maybe slow down a bit and again, bring reality back into the situation.
With a Democratic-led legislature, it's unclear if these bills will move forward without some level of support from Democratic lawmakers. And some Democratic lawmakers say while the government can extend a deadline, Mother Nature will not. Koh says the Environmental Justice Alliance plans to continue to push state leaders and lawmakers to comply with the Climate Act through organizing at public hearings, letter campaigns, and rallies. And while legislators await upcoming legislative session to hammer out policies around this issue, some climate experts say New Yorkers don't have to solely rely on the government to decide how and when to protect the environment.
You can't just say, this politician is worried sufficiently for me, so I'm not going to worry about it. It doesn't work that way. It's communities that really make these things work. And I think as a community, we need to have that kind of concern.
Friedman says there are a lot of ways individuals can reduce their carbon footprint, from purchasing an electric vehicle and using more energy-efficient appliances to simply using less plastic. Research shows that the plastics industry is currently responsible for 4 times more greenhouse gas emissions than the airline industry. So while the impact of reducing plastic pollution may seem minimal on an individual scale, it can still make a difference. In Albany, I'm Elise Klein for the New York Public News Network.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, local economic perspective from James B. Huntington. This is Radio Chatskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
Jazz happening live. Inspiration in the moment. At Jazz Night in America, we're capturing that spark each and every week, and now you can hear those inspiring performances on Radio Catskill. I'm Christian McBride. Join me for Jazz Night in America every Sunday night at 8, starting October 6th on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's Monday, and we check in every Monday with local author and local economist James B. Huntington. It's Work Shift Live. James B., good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Well, we got some inflation news again. I guess we've got numbers in from August. And what happened with inflation in this latest sign of inflation progress, I guess?
Well, this is what they call the Fed's preferred inflation gauge, and it is the personal consumption expenditures. It went up 2.2% from a year earlier, which is down significantly from 2.5% last time. It's 2.7%, though, if you include food, if you strip out food and fuel prices, went down or up pretty much nothing over the past month. So that's what they're looking at here. So the commentary here is from the New York Times, as the report offers further proof that price increases are swiftly fading. So it's looking lower for inflation. We'll see. They collect these and report on them every month, but most of the damage, as before, has been done when inflation was higher and pushed prices up. They're not getting much higher now.
And does this indicate this slowing of inflation? Does it indicate that the Fed might make another rate cut?
Oh, very likely they will. They want to. They would like to. It's going to depend on the data they collect further on, such as the jobs report, which comes out this Friday. Word about how we did with employment in September, but they are positioned to do that again. They would like to. Obviously, they couldn't do it before, but now they are probably going to bring interest rates down again if the data behaves itself.
Yeah. And this is their Fed's preferred measure of inflation, the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index. Does that translate to consumer spending?
Yes.
Okay.
It's what people are actually spending.
All right. Just wanted to get the lingo correct here. What you also have some news about the economy, as it's inflation slowing, and some of this is rebounding from the pandemic. Still after these years, the economy is still recovering. How quickly did it rebound?
Well, quicker than they thought. They've revised data from 2021 to 2023, and it looks like we got out of the pandemic faster than we had thought before. So GDP went up in 21, 22, and early in 23. So the recovery now, as they're saying, it was stronger and more consistent than earlier data showed. So it actually grew in the second quarter of 2022, when they had thought before it actually went down. But it is not showing any two consecutive quarters of declining GDP, in other words. So some people were using that as a way of saying we're in a recession now. Well, we never were. So that's what this says. So we're in better shape. We have been in better shape than the official data told us before.
A report out last week about Generation Z finding other ways to get around than by purchasing cars or you know, driving them even. They're kind of relying on what, public transportation and ride sharing?
Yes, well, ride sharing has not been as responsible as they thought. What happened? The numbers are, the percentage was 87% in 1983, and in 2022 it was less than 69%. So that's almost one third of 19-year-olds not having a driver's license, and that's quite unusual, certainly from my adolescence and such. It was something everybody passionately wanted to get into, was being able to drive, often buying a car. And they're not doing that nearly as much. So what we have here is also the share of Generation Z buying new and used cars. That's actually dropped over the last 2 years. Only 1.1%, but that's strange given that Generation Z people are getting older and the younger ones are getting into the age where it's more common for them to buy cars and such. They're not doing it nearly as much. They're talking about the real reason here being that people are using their parents for transportation, more than bicycles, more than public transportation, and more than Uber and Lyft. Those things are making much less of a difference, but a lot of people are just going with their parents at increasingly older ages. So I don't know about college students. Sometimes when they talk about people who are 18 to 22, they don't differentiate between college students whose lives are different and those who are working, but colleges have long been set up so that people don't really need cars. The normal residential ones where people live on campus or nearby. So they can be protected there and not have as many of them trying to get cars. I suspect it's something to do with the tuition getting higher and higher, even in constant dollars, that they don't have enough money to get cars, which is really, really a luxury for most full-time college students and something many of them probably right now can't afford. And you have so many who don't have licenses now. So it's shrinking. I imagine there have been books written on this, but you could certainly write one about the enthusiasm for youth about driving and how it was such a big thing, and now it really isn't. Yeah. People are saying they don't care, they can't afford it, they'd rather spend money on other things, they'd rather not bother with driving if they don't have to. That would certainly be strange to someone my age.
Well, it is a big financial burden no matter your age. Normally I would say to these the youth, maybe save your pennies, but you've got a story about how folks are wanting to abolish the penny. It's something that's kind of been around for a little bit, but why are folks wanting to abolish the penny?
Well, it's the better question is, why have they lasted as long as they have?
Right, right.
We have some staggering statistics here that came out a couple weeks ago, which described it as being stupendously stupid that we still have pennies. The reasons are, one, there are about 240 billion pennies. That's almost a quarter trillion just lying around the United States, not doing anything, not being spent, nothing, about 724 for every person of any age in the United States. We also have two-thirds of the pennies made in the last 30 years have just dropped out of circulation. They're just piling up in places at people's houses. We have Obama, when he was president, said it's very hard to get rid of things that don't work. There have been efforts now and again, but there's really no doubt that they have no value of them. In order to bring enough to get enough pennies to buy a soda at McDonald's, you're talking about 2 or 3 pounds worth. And people just plain aren't doing that. They aren't putting them back into circulation as used to be the norm. We have, this is lobbying by a company that makes the blanks and is getting them or talking them really into keeping these things going, even though there is more and more pressure. We have even the fundraisers who collect pennies just not doing that anymore because people don't have them handy, even though they have them.
Right.
There's no evidence that a lot of Americans are using pennies to make purchases or rely on them in any way. We have the U.S. and Canada being the only countries in the world that I know of anyway that add sales tax to prices instead of figuring it into the prices. And so transactions always usually dribble out with significant numbers of coins, where if you're in the Eurozone, you're liable to buy something small with one coin and get another coin back in change. And it's not the equivalent of a penny.
It's not the penny.
So,
the penny paradox. We got to get going here in a few minutes. So I want to make sure we get to the numbers and let us know where things are in terms of a stock and all the other prices.
Yes. Yeah, so the numbers now. Okay. Well, gold over the last week, as of early this morning, 26.51, up 35. Again, all-time high. It seems like whatever happens, gold goes up. It has that's been doing that recently a lot, more and more. Silver, $31.46, up $1.04. The ratio is 84-1, which is more reasonable, given we may have a new normal for that with India's tariff going away. Gold may be more than 80-1 consistently now. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, 42,313, up an even 250 for the week. All-time high or close again. Same thing goes for NASDAQ, which was 18,119 plus 171. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, 68,45, down $2.60. I tell you, I was traveling over the last weekend, and I paid $285, $287, and $299 in New Jersey, Connecticut, and Maine. So it's consistently, very commonly, under $3 a gallon now, which is a great improvement. Bitcoin, 64,313, up 715, still in the 60s, not doing much, but it could go up or down a couple thousand at any time. British pound, 1.3420, up 1.5 cents. Very happy because of American interest rates going down. And the euro, up a little over 1 cent to 1.1205. Japanese 100 yen stayed at 70 cents. At least it's staying at a better place now. So overall, really a perfect week. Everything went up, almost everything went up, except for oil, which went down. So where we want to see them.
That's where we want to see them. We got to run. James B. Huntington, local author and economist, joins us every Monday for a look at the economy. Thanks so much. We'll see you next Monday.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
Working 9 to 5, what a way to make it.
All right. Thank you, James V. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's been a quarter of a century since the North Branch Cider Mills Press last ran. The new owners are working to restore it. Radio Catskill contributor Isabel Braverman has more.
Yep. So I'm Tom. I'm the new owner of the North Branch Cider Mill. And we're here in the store right now in this beautiful old structure. And, you know, I like to think it has a real old-time shop feel.
Tom Roberts and his wife, Anna Aberg, are breathing new life into the North Branch Cider Mill. The historic Sullivan County landmark first opened in 1942. And after going through many iterations of owners, it shuttered its doors in 1999. North Branch is a town with apples at its core. The earliest settlers cultivated apple trees on their property and produced hard cider. Around the turn of the 20th century, apples were big business in western Sullivan County, and the area was famous for them. North Branch alone had several successful apple operations. In the 1970s, under new ownership, the North Branch Cider Mill became a major visitor attraction. Tom and Anna wanted to continue that beloved business model and keep the tradition alive today.
People come in, they tell me all sorts of stories about the place, and what we endeavor to do is make sure that when these people are returning and they have warm memories of the place, it still feels familiar. And, you know, that month that we opened was just so unbelievably heartwarming. People walked in and, like, I don't know if tears were shed, but I felt like it was pretty close a few times. And to me, that was what success looked like. It was to bring this place back in a way that it didn't feel like it was transformed into something else, but it felt like it had new life.
And of course, there's the cider mill. The 150-year-old cider press has been out of operation, but Tom and Anna are trying their hardest to bring it back to working order.
The press is a 150-year-old press. It works great, but it hasn't been updated, really. I think the last update was putting an electric motor in. Before that, it ran off a Chevy pickup truck that they put on bricks. So that was the last major update, and it needs a lot more to bring it up to the current health code. And they couldn't do it, and I'm starting to discover all the reasons why. The press is all original. It did get moved at some point. I think that was when the Giffords owned the place. They moved it into this extension at the back. The way it works is we've got a door at the side that slides open, and that's where the apples come in, big like 500-pound crates of apples. And there's hydraulics up there that lift the apples and drop them into this hopper, and then the apples will run down into the apple washer. Now, our apple washer is completely broken. If anybody has an old apple washer they want to sell, give me a call. But the apples will go through the apple washer, and then we have this incredible old wooden conveyor belt that's all powered off this big old electric motor. And the conveyor belt lifts the apples up to the ceiling, drops them through the masher, which is kind of a drum masher. It just spins and smushes the apples together. And that goes down onto one of these kind of rolling platforms where you just stack the plates of apples, and then you roll that across into the hydraulics, which also run on electric now, smush the apples, and then they'll go down into tanks into the basement.
From there, their plan is to UV filter the apple cider to make it safe for sale.
It's a really magical spot, so I've always dreamed of creating a space where you could come and have a cup of tea or coffee and a slice of cake or a sandwich and sit by the river and spend an afternoon. We have goats in the back now as well, and you can feed the goats, and just a real family-friendly place. This one is custard. This is rhubarb. Licorice is over there. It's taffy. And then the three sheep, that's Barbara, Barbette, and Barbie. And then this little baby brown one is Peanut. And then the black and white one there is our only male goat. That's Mark Ruffalo.
For more information, visit www.homestead.com. For WJFF, this is Isabel Braverman.
And that'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Speaking of apples, enter our Apple Pie Palooza Apple Pie Baking Contest. Details at our website, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Artist Cottage Bed and Breakfast, a newly renovated farmhouse that sleeps four with full gourmet cook breakfast provided daily, located near the top of Hauk Mountain Road in the town of Walton. More information at greatwesterncatskills.com.
The Narrowsburg Chamber of Commerce presents Logging Days, 11 to 5, Saturday, October 5th, Fireman's Field, Narrowsburg, featuring the New York State Lumberjack Association's Lumberjack Contest, Beard and Mustache Contest, axe throwing, line dancing lessons, baking contest, kids activities, beer garden, food, and more. Logging Days, 11 to 5, Saturday, October 5th in Narrowsburg. More information at welcometonarrowsburg.com. Paid for by the Narrowsburg Chamber of Commerce.
Radio Catskill and StoryCorps invite you to have a conversation with One Small Step, bringing people with different political beliefs together to simply talk about their lives. Apply today at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, partly sunny, pleasant, and warmer, high 71. Mostly cloudy tonight, low 52. Tomorrow, cloudy, 65. And Wednesday, a passing shower or two. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.